Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Peter Oborne in Chiswick, West London.
Hello, it's Richard Heller in Bermondsey, South East London. We've had a little bit of a break and been some momentous cricket developments here in England. First of all, recreational cricket is back in England this weekend, and all recreational cricketers, I think, owe a huge debt of gratitude to Nick Ferrari for interviewing Boris Johnson about this on LBC Radio, and he made him say something so foolish about cricket that we had to have a policy U-turn almost within hours. And that was thanks to Nick Ferrari. We have recreational cricket back again. I think he should be honoured in Wisden next year.
Nick Ferrari asked the Prime Minister whether recreation cricket could start again, and the Prime Minister said, no, not at all. There's too much going on in the changing rooms and teas and all that. It was palpable bilge, palpable nonsense, such nonsense that by tea time, by the time they pour the teas, there'd been a dramatic screeching of brakes and smell of burning rubber, and cricket was back on again.
It was. So all thanks to Nick Ferrari for making Boris Johnson say something really stupid. If we could interview Boris Johnson every day, we might have better government. More importantly, we're watching a gripping test match between England and the West Indies. I think more importantly still, we had two powerful and moving interventions on Black Lives Matter and the impact of racism by Michael Holding, which I think electrified Britain and I think possibly the whole world, anybody who's seen them. And it occurred to me that if he wanted to pursue this path, Michael Holding might follow Leary Constantine into the House of Lords.
I very much agree with that, Richard, although I wonder even if Her Majesty might offer him the Order of Merit or something like that in her personal gift, just to symbolise the way that his words really moved us all and said so much about the society we want to become.
I think so. There might not be a vacancy in the Order of Merit. You're only allowed 24 of them at a time. But I think he'd be an adornment to the House of Lords. He might be Lord Holding of the Oval, commemorating his great performance, and he'd certainly binge up the Lords and Commons cricket team.
Which you have played many times.
That's a very good reason for inviting Michael Holding to play in my place.
Now, we have the most fantastic... We're so pleased about our guest. Before we introduce him, tell us a little bit about him, Richard.
Well, our guest was a world-renowned umpire. He was the ICC's Umpire of the Year, 5 years running. He then retired from umpiring. He became the ICC's umpire performance and training manager. He's now has his own consultancy on leadership and performance, appropriately operating from Bowral, the hometown of Don Bradman. And we're thrilled to welcome Simon Telfer.
Who is, I believe, in Bowral, in Don Bradman's own hometown.
I am indeed. Thank you, Richard and Peter, for that very kind introduction, and it's great to be with you. It is in the middle of winter here in Bradman's backyard, and Bill O'Reilly's backyard for that matter too. Bill O'Reilly grew up only about 20 kilometres down the road, Tiger O'Reilly, as he may have been referred to for many years. And it's great to be with you talking cricket and talking umpiring and all things sport. It's great.
Simon, most of us, you know, grew up in the 50s and 60s, think of umpires as... you know, people of Peter's and my generation who grew up in the 50s and 60s. Well, this is a very, very important generational point. We were mostly used to umpires who were, you know, of quite advanced years, mostly retired players.
Sure. But Bill Alley was one of them.
Something like the two notable Australians, Bill Alley and Cess Pepper, who were notable umpires in England. But you were something very, very different. You began umpiring, I think, when you were 20 as a result of an injury which ended your career as a fast bowler. You played for New South Wales under 19. And I think it was a chance intervention that switched you on to umpiring, wasn't it?
Very much so. I became the accidental umpire as one of my fast bowling colleagues at local cricket wanted to become an umpire himself and coerced me into doing a laws and training course with the New South Wales Cricket Umpires and Scorers Association, as they are now. And we did those 4 nights. We did those 10 hours, sat the exam, and 85% pass mark was the target. I managed to get over that line, and my mate David, who was the coercer, unfortunately didn't reach that that mark. So he went back to continue opening the bowling left arm over around the wicket. And thought I'd give cricket umpiring a go. But I must say that it wasn't my first introduction to cricket umpiring in the outdoor variety. I actually started a couple of years earlier before that with the indoor variety at Barry Knight's Indoor Cricket Centre in Chatswood here in Sydney, where I worked part-time through my secondary college years and under Barry's guidance became a relatively competent indoor cricket umpire, working and honing my skills on run-outs and caught behinds down the leg side. So that was my sort of introduction to cricket umpiring, and I also met my current wife there many, many years ago in the late 80s. So cricket and indoor cricket and outdoor cricket certainly in my blood and remain so.
Just a factual point, but Barry Knight of Essex in England.
Correct. And Barry actually lives here in Barrel as well, so he's still...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Went through the Aussie team in the first innings of the second test in 68. Do you remember that?
Yep.
He got 5 wickets, I think. They dropped Oliveira, brought in Barry Knight, and he bowled beautifully on a green wicket.
He did.
Trent Bridge, I think it was.
I'll take your word for it. I was born in 71, yep. So that counts me up.
You umpired your first test at Australia West Indies, December 2000, aged 29, and you were younger than 12 of the players in both teams, and I'm pretty certain that is a world record. You also had two former under-19 teammates in the Australian side, didn't you? Michael Slater and Adam Gilchrist.
Mm. Fascinating, isn't it? And back to your previous point about umpires of your generation, and particularly when I started officiating, being old enough to be my father and some of them probably old enough to be my grandfather. We certainly broke the mould, I think, around when I started to come through Sydney grade cricket and then breaking into first class cricket. I was 24, I think I was, when I did my first class match at the SCG between New South Wales and South Australia, with people like Darren Lehman playing for South Australia and Greg Matthews and co and the Wars playing for New South Wales. And we certainly did break the mould in terms of the age group, the demographic, but also the physique. And I think it was fair to say that we started the age of umpiring sort of catching up to the players a little bit in professionalism and the way that we were going to go about our craft. And what's really interesting is we've developed that professionalism around preparation, around performance, around self-assessment, around feedback, around the pathway and the meritocracy related to it, and the transparency of performance, particularly amongst the umpiring fraternity, and having to officiate, as you said, players that were either around my age group, contemporaries if you like, and also players that were slightly older than me, was a challenge in a couple of ways. First of all, I didn't have that generational gap of, you know, a father or a grandfather of having to respect an elder. I didn't have that. So I suppose in a way it was a good thing for me, because I was forced into earning respect and credibility through performance. And it was purely and simply around that. That's not to say that some of those contemporaries that I might have played with weren't looking for some favour or looking for some, you know, slack in some areas. But I simply had to perform and let my umpiring do the talking. And in a lot of ways, that's exactly how I wanted it. I didn't want a free ride. I wanted to let my umpiring do the talking and just treat one game at a time and see how it went. And all of a sudden, when I hit first class cricket at the age of 24, I really started to take it reasonably seriously as a career path, because when I started, I had no ambition or vision or dream to become an international cricket umpire. I just wanted to do my best, enjoy what I did, and contribute to the game of cricket.
That's very interesting. So what you emerge on the scene at an extraordinary moment in global cricket, when it's reinventing itself. The one-day game is becoming much bigger, the new short-form games, the professionalisation of the sport, the money coming into the sport through TV. And you sort of symbolise a moment when umpiring also becomes far more managerial, structured, professional. Is that a fair point?
Well, the sport might have been heading in that direction, but I'm not sure the cricket umpiring was. You know, I remember my first test match at the MCG and receiving my couple of business shirts from the management and my stickers, my National Grid stickers, who were sponsoring us at the time, and I would affix those to my shirt every day and peel them off to launder my shirt of a night time. But there was no preparation. There was no match report that I received at the end of the game to tell me what people thought of me. I didn't see a copy of the captain's report. And so from my perspective, it was reasonably straightforward in terms of the way that we were appointed, the way that we did the game and the way that we finished. But there was no continuous improvement cycle. And I felt very uncomfortable with that. So for me, I was always developing my own way of preparing, my own way of self-assessment, my own way of continuing my own improvement, because I didn't want to become a victim to the lack of structural professionalism within the umpiring system. And because my performance was very public, and we're very much a team-focused organisation in today's cricket, I didn't want to leave anything to chance. And as a result, I think a lot of what we were doing back then sort of evolved around, well, how do we improve the system? Let's look at preparation net sessions. Let's look at self-assessments. Let's look at performance reports. Let's look at tracking what works and what doesn't work. And I was very lucky coming through the system when I did, from a Cricket Australia perspective, because I was able to tap into the resources of what was then the number one team in the world. And so that's why I tapped into Jock Campbell, the Australian fitness coach at the time. I tapped into Simone Austin and dietitians. I tapped into and cross-pollinated with other sports. And I mentioned Daryl Hare in my book around tapping into him. And he got me really involved in cross-pollination with good sports in Australia like National Rugby League, and Mick Stone, who was running the rugby league back then, Russell Trotter, who was running Australian rugby match officiating, and him and I developed a really good coaching relationship, and he still is my coach today in some respects. And I wanted to find out from those sports what I could do better, how I could always improve myself, because I think that's where we were lacking. You know, our umpiring system at that stage was very amateurish, and I'm not afraid to say that. And today it's so much better, and we've come a long way in 25 years, we really have.
That's a big theme of your book, Finding the Gaps, and I'll repeat that at dictation speed. It's a service we do for all our guests who've written a book. Finding the Gaps. The intensity of your own sort of preparations, your own personal and mental and physical development of being an umpire, but also what comes over is the change in the role of umpires, the change in the preparations that umpires do before and indeed during and indeed after a match. You describe that as no preparation at all for that first test match.
That's right.
But now you're involved in lots and lots of issues which go way beyond the laws and the playing conditions. You're involved in issues like physical security, technology, health and safety. See in your book, even you're involved in decisions about catering. And there's also, special roles for the third and the fourth umpire, which weren't around when you began.
No, well, Richard, you're right. I mean, in that book, I talk about transferable skills, and they're not just cricket umpiring skills. And I sort of cut my teeth as a print operations manager before I took on umpiring full time. And preparation is king. Preparation is everything. And I learned through my apprenticeship as a cricket umpire how important preparation was around being ready for the match, because when the opportunity comes along, it's too late to prepare. And now for me, and what I've learnt throughout my career, world-class preparation is about asking what ifs. And we can sort of prepare for the knowns, but we also have to try and prepare for the unknowns, the what ifs, as I call them. And we don't get the opportunity to umpire the ball a second time. We don't get the opportunity to umpire the match a second time. And what can you do to give yourself the best opportunity of being successful? Now, cricket's a fascinating sport because it's not a science, it's an art, it's a craft. And through technology, we do try at times to turn it into a science, but it's not. You know, cricket is not played with a perfectly round ball. The pitch is not perfectly flat. We play across different weather conditions. We have two different umpires out there. We play across multiple days. It's not a science, it's an art and a craft. And I think what we have to try and do is to be ready for most eventualities if we can, within reason. But I can't sell the point strongly enough that preparation is king. And for me, that was very much a checklist-driven focus from my print management days, where I would try and reduce the element of human error as much as possible. And our game is built on human error. The best umpires in the world make the fewest amounts of mistakes, but we still make mistakes. And making mistakes is part of cricket umpiring, and it's part of getting better. That mental toughness that I talk in the book about, bounce back ability and resilience, and sort of embracing mistakes, at the time they feel terrible, they They almost feel like you've lost a child or you've lost a member of the family. You go through this grieving process of trying to recover from a mistake, but then you're able to sit back and reflect on that and say, what's the learning opportunity here? And if I had my time over again, what would I do differently? All these concepts come together to develop this continuous improvement cycle about trying to get better every game as a cricket umpire. Because when I started out umpiring, people expected me to be perfect and then somehow get better. And being a match official, you have to meet this expectation where you get nothing wrong. And when you get nothing wrong, people say nothing. And you get something wrong, and they say everything. Everyone's an expert. But it's a very, very strange, tightrope that you walk, where as cricket umpires, we're all sort of driven by fear, that fear of making a mistake. We love it when we get our appointments, and they're like a Christmas present. They're like a box of chocolates when they come along. And then you can't wait to get through the game and survive it and put it behind you and get through relatively unscathed. But it is a game of survival. It's a very unique opportunity and a unique task that we do. And it's not for everyone. It's not for the faint-hearted. It's character building. It's character unveiling. But I love Test cricket because it tests you mentally, physically, emotionally, sometimes even spiritually. And that's what makes it fascinating. And I would really encourage people to try being a cricket umpire, but I certainly acknowledge it's not for everyone.
It's so interesting what you're saying. Give us an example of the worst error we've put you through all that grief and how you then handled the criticism.
Isn't it funny that people always ask me about errors? They don't ask me about good decisions.
Well, they're just so unusual. They stick out.
It goes to my point that when you do the right thing, no one cares. But when you make a mistake, they're all interested. And how did you get to that point? And, let's dissect the umpiring error. But just interesting the psyche around that. For me, I can tell you about multiple errors. I describe a few in the book around my worst test match. But I'll take you one that I haven't talked about in the book, which was a one-day international early on that I did at the SCG between Australia and the West Indies. And I've actually recounted this story when I caught up with Darren Ganga recently at the Caribbean Premier League last year. And we remained good friends as a result, because as a quick aside, I genuinely believe that breakdowns lead to breakthroughs. And Darren and I had a breakdown moment in the middle of the SCG. He's having a bad run of form on tour. He's opening the batting against Glenn McGrath. There's a loud shout from LBW, from Glenn's bowling. I'm at the bowler's end. I give Darren out LBW. Australian crowd goes wild. They're extremely happy. Darren's not looking too pleased and trudges off. And I walk across to my umpiring colleague at the time, Daryl Hare, and I say, Daryl, how did that look for height, mate? He said, I was a bit surprised. It looked a bit high. And as we're sort of having this wicket discussion, the big replay screen shows the replay of the LBW decision from the mid-off position, and there's a huge inside edge from Darren's bat onto his pad, and the crowd let out this huge groan of, oh, how did you get that one wrong? And of course, in slow motion on a big replay screen, high definition, it looks 10 times worse than what it is. Nevertheless, I'm looking for a hole in the middle of the SCG to crawl into and to be able to dive into that and try to escape the public humiliation and shame that I'm just experiencing right now. And for those of you who may have seen the SCG on TV or have had the fortune to be there, the umpires actually have to walk off the ground through the members' crowd, through the members' bar, and up the staircase to get to the umpire's room. Now, you can imagine some of the free advice that I got walking off after that session from the members around my performance and particularly that decision. And that's one particular decision. I don't watch a lot of my replays around errors, but this is one that I did because I really wanted to try to understand how I got it wrong. And I watched it and I watched it and I watched it over and over again, and I could never work out how I got it wrong. And to this day, they're like battle scars for me, these errors. You remember all of your big mistakes like they were yesterday. They're clearly imprinted in your mind because memory is attached to emotion, and when you feel so bad or so good about something, you really hang on to it. But I can recount all of my big mistakes because they stay with me. They are battle scars. I remember Mark Waugh would always put a notch on his thigh pad for the number of test hundreds he would score. Well, I've got notches and scratches etched in my mind from all the big mistakes that I've made, I'll tell you that much. But it is a grieving process you go through about denial and deflection, and you wish that it didn't happen, and you just have to move through this faster. And the best way that I've learnt to do this, and I've said to a few people that if I had my career over again, what would I do differently? This is one area that I would do differently, where I would talk more about my shortcomings and about my failures and about my errors to be able to move through this grieving process faster. And the best way to do that is to acknowledge the fact that you've made a mistake, is to accept that you're human, is to think about these things rationally, about what can I learn from what's just happened, and proactively do something positive with that information. And take the third person in the room view of this to say, well, mistakes are part of what we do. Mistakes are part of getting better. They're going to hurt, but what can we do rationally to get through this as quickly as possible? And how do we make our next game the best game that we can umpire? And that's the continuous improvement cycle that I talk about. So I've talked briefly there about a major error, how it feels, their emotional responses. And in the book, I talk about how we get emotionally hijacked after something happens and we lose connection with the moment. And as a cricket umpire, it's really important that, you know, we all say, well, you know, don't worry about that. Put it behind you. Focus on the next delivery. Well, talk is cheap. This is why it's really important to practice that skill of acceptance, acknowledgement, being rational, not getting emotionally hijacked, and reconnecting with the moment, and thinking less and doing more. And that's when we get in that zone of peak performance.
Of course, what you're talking about there, I was thinking as you spoke, it's so interesting. It doesn't, of course, just apply in any way only to umpiring. It applies to all kinds of modes of human activity.
Spot on. And that's exactly why in early parts of my career, I was doing lots of research and having conversations with people who were best in world. So whether that was through a book and having a conversation with a Michael Schumacher, looking at a Roger Federer, looking at a Tiger Woods, or looking at someone in their own particular field of golf or even business. And I did a lot of work around Jim Collins and a lot of corporate people. Steve Jobs comes to mind as well. You know, what was their secret of success? Even though that there's no new science in this area, but what were they doing that I could tap into and apply to my chosen field of endeavor? And that's why I wrote that book around transferable skills and about why the soft skills are the difference between being good and great. And as an umpire selector recently with Cricket Australia, I would look at the four C's. I'd look at the competencies and the capabilities, and they got you in the door to get the job interview, to have a crack. But it was the character and the chemistry, the other two C's, that were the determination about whether you got the job and whether long-term you were going to be successful at the chosen endeavour. In this case, cricket umpiring.
Simon, your errors were in fact very, very unusual, and that's perhaps why people focus on them. As an ICC umpire, you had a success rate of 96% in your decisions, which is, you know, really quite a breathtaking statistic for, you know, for almost any field to get 96% of something right. Take us to the mirror image of the decision that's given you grief. What's the decision that you think you got most spectacularly right and that you're most proud of?
Yeah, thank you for that. Thanks for the opportunity to actually talk about some positivity around cricket umpiring and what we do well. But I must say up front that, you know, cricket umpiring is not just about decision making. And I think it's a very narrow window that we always, or a lens that we look at cricket umpiring through, is just about decision making. We might talk maybe about those other skills and attributes as we continue this discussion. But I remember sort of still new on the scene after my first Cricket World Cup in 2003, after I was fortunately appointed to the ICC Elite Panel. And one of my first tours away was the India-Pakistan series, where those two countries played each other for the first time in around about 15 years again. And
it was
a home
Pakistan,
series.
Wasn't it? Home series
in Pakistan. And as you can imagine, there was a quite a significant amount of media attention to that, and what a great opportunity to be part of that series with people like David Shepherd, etc. But there was a decision I remember in Multan, and India were batting, and Irfan Pathan, left-hander, quite a decent all-rounder, bowling all-rounder if you like. Irfan Pathan was on 90-something, and he was batting against, I think it was someone like, might have been one of the medium pacers, Abdul Razak or someone like that. And he's playing half forward and it's gone pad bat. And there's an LBW appeal. Now, bat and pad were very close together. And of course, whenever an umpire hears two noises, most of the time they'll give the benefit of doubt to the batsman. It's sort of a tough decision, and very rarely will they give a positive LBW decision in those cases. But on this particular day, I was seeing the ball quite well. I could clearly see it hit pad first and then onto the bat in quick succession, and I duly gave Irfan Pathan out. Now, Irfan, lovely man, off the field and on the field for that matter too. Great bowler to have from your end, and very cooperative, and an absolute pleasure to officiate. Well, obviously, was very disappointed, not happy. Pakistan were very delighted at the time. Irfan's missed out on what would have been a fantastic 100. But I was very happy with the decision at the time. But of course, whenever a batsman's not happy, it tends to create a little bit of a doubt in your mind as they leave the wicket. But I remember having a conversation with Dave Richardson a day or two later, who was the ICC General Manager of Cricket at that stage. And David sort of went out of his way to give me a pat on the back for getting that decision right, on the basis that, in his experience, a lot of umpires at the international level were not prepared to make that tough decision or to make that courageous call and call it the way that they see it and just hide behind the two noises. And I just thought, well, this is just normal for me. It's what I do. If I think it's out, I'm going to back myself and give it.
Momentous decision to make at the National Stadium, Multan, in that test match. Wow.
Wow. Yep.
Yeah. Particularly for an Indian batsman on, 90-something. Yeah. But, so those sorts of ones are always nice to get right. Or when you get a ball that jags back in between bat and pad and there's a noise, and you don't give it out, and it turns out to be the top of the pad or just the top of the thigh, and you're the one that sees it clearly. But, here we are in today, and you've thrown a figure of 96 or so percent correct. And what we know from DRS today, and particularly when I left the system, was that the players generally were getting the DRS review correct around about 22% of the time. I think today it's probably around the 33, 34%. That the players get it right, they successfully challenge. And I'd put it to you and your audience, well, if the players are getting it right 22, 33% of the time, and the umpires are getting it right somewhere between 90 and 96% of the time, who do you want umpiring the game of cricket? and that's what we always face, is that regardless of how well you do as a cricket umpire, whether it's 96 out of 100 you get right, people will always focus on the 4 out of 100 that you don't. And that's just the nature of what we do.
You mentioned David Sheppard a moment ago, and in your book you describe a lovely partnership you had with him whenever you umpired with him, and how important it is to have partnerships with your fellow umpire. And I wonder in particular, Simon, if you'd like to tell the story of the lovely partnership you shared in Pakistan after a hard day.
Well, I will get to that story, but probably the point that I'd like to make to the audience here is that umpiring is a team sport, just like the other two teams. And I definitely keep advocating and keep pushing in the public domain this third team concept, that you need to have three teams to play any game successfully, regardless of what the sport is. And cricket's no different. And for me, teamwork starts with being a team off the field. And this has corporate analogies as well, is that if you want a really good team in the office, you need to be a team away from the workplace as well. And my teamwork with David Sheppard started when he was visiting Australia and I was doing third umpire work at the international level before I got to the elite panel. And I would probably be a third umpire for David either in Sydney or Brisbane. But in this particular case, I first came into contact with David in Sydney as a third umpire. And part of my initial challenge was to get to know him as a person. And what that meant for me was that I would look after him. I would take him places. I would try to be around the umpiring environment off the field as we were preparing for the test match and get to know him, get to know his needs, his likes, his dislikes, so that we could be a team in the heat of battle. And that would mean taking David to places like Bondi Beach. And for any of the audience that have been to Bondi Beach, it's an iconic venue in Sydney. And sometimes there's pretty ladies on the beach and sometimes they don't always wear the amount of clothing that they're supposed to wear. And Shep was quite happy to be in that environment. And we sort of started to develop a relationship around enjoying each other's company off the field, which made our work in umpiring a lot easier. And then I take that experience in the mid-90s. And then when I'm faced of doing a series which is like World War III, India, Pakistan, with Shep in Pakistan around about 2004, I think it might have been 2003-04. And here we are in Multan. And before I get to that story, we're checking into the Multan Holiday Inn, which is about the only decent hotel in Multan, Inzamam's hometown.
I've stayed there too. Jolly good it is too.
Yeah, it's very basic. It's nothing to write home about. Concrete walls and not much in between. And I remember walking up to the check-in counter with David Shepherd, and the man behind the desk in broken English says to David Shepherd, "Oh, Mr. Shepherd, it's wonderful to see you here. We have specially prepared this room for you, and we really hope you enjoy your stay with us." And he proceeds to hand David his room key. And what number room do you think they gave Mr. Shepherd? Well, of course, it was 111. And cool. Yep. David's face was just a ghost at being handed a room key with 111 on it. Of course, we all know Shep's, Shep's superstition and fascination with that number. And he said, "Oh no, that's no. I cannot accept that room." And then he proceeded to try for another room, which he successfully got. And then the person behind the desk walks up to Mr. Madigali and says, "Mr. Madigali, welcome. It's great to have you with us. We've specially prepared this room for you. We hope you enjoy your stay with us. And here is your room key, room number 111. So Ranjan Madigali duly accepted the room and moved on. But then we got to the test match, of course, in Multan, 42 degrees, 43 degrees. Nice English weather. And we duly got rid of our ICC ties for the start of the game, and we proceeded to get through 6 or 7 hours of cricket on the day in 42-degree heat. And what I really appreciated and loved about Shep was his care and passion for performing well. We both walked off the field tired, sweaty, exhausted, and Shep sort of falls into this leatherette armchair in a very sparse and pristine umpire's room, very clinical, wall-to-wall tiles, not much in the room, but he looked up at Ranjan Madigali and says, "Hey, Chief, how did I go? Was everything all right?" And Shep's sitting there with sweat dripping off his forehead. His white shirt is pretty much saturated and almost see-through from the amount of sweat. He's got bright, rosy cheeks, and he's severely dehydrated. In the meantime, I'm sort of changing back into my training gear, my shorts and my T-shirt, and I'm going to go for a bit of a warm down, as was my practice back in those days. And I'm going to do a couple of warm down laps, and I'm going to do a bit of a stretch. And as I've exited the room, for those of you who don't know, Shep was a bit of a diabetic, and he wasn't supposed to have too much sugar in his diet. And he would try to weasel out of the caterers some ice cream, normally after an end of a day's play. And so he's put in that request with the catering staff. "Oh, is there any ice cream at all?" And we have three flavours. We have vanilla, chocolate and strawberry. "Oh, I'll have vanilla, please." "Okay, Shep, well, you can have my scoop of ice cream." And he says, "Hey, Sai, would you do an extra lap for me too when you go out there?" I said, "Job done, Shep. It's a deal. You have my ice cream. I'll do an extra lap for you." And that was the way that we got on. And I really respect and admire Shep, as I mentioned, because of the way that he would care about his performance, but also too because of his wonderful ability to build relationships across different religions, different age groups, different denominations, socioeconomic backgrounds. And one of Shep's famous phrases that will always stick with me is he'd shake your hand and he would say, "May your God go with you." And he struck me just as a real, real good person. And if I learnt nothing else from Shep about trying to be a good umpire, was that to be a good umpire, you had to be a good person to start with. You needed those fundamental skills about building relationships, trying to accept people for who they are, doing your best, working hard, and trusting in yourself, but more particularly about trusting in others, and being very, very vulnerable around your own performance and about your own capabilities, and and having a high care factor for what you did. And for those reasons, I will always remember Shep very fondly, and he'll always be one of my special people. When I walk out on a cricket field and I raise my head to look at the sun and sort of get my pupils nice and ready for what's about to happen, I always thank three people. David Shepherd's one of them. Ted Wykes is another, who was a great mentor of mine and a great confidant. And Alan Marshall, who left us far too early here in New South Wales, who taught me a lot about cricket umpiring and also about the skills of technique. And they're three people that I always thank every time I walk out on a cricket field.
Simon, you had the terrible experience of being involved in the attack on the Sri Lankan team in Lahore in 2009. You were umpiring that test match and you were in the umpire's van that was shot up. Mm. And you've described that experience very vividly in your book. It must have been absolutely, well, clearly was absolutely terrifying.
Earlier on in this session, I talked about breakdowns leading to breakthroughs, and you've touched on, I've written about this experience in my book. It's the first chapter. It's called The Hardest Call I've Had to Make. And it was a terrible experience, no question. And the officials who were in that bus, particularly Steve Davis, Chris Broad, Peter Manuel, Asan Raza, Nadeem Gowri, Abdul Sami Khan, our liaison officer, and Zafir, our driver, one of which is no longer with us. Our driver was killed, unfortunately, that day, and there were two other significant injuries in our van.
Have you been in touch with the other victims at all since that time? Are you all in touch with each other?
But I do keep in touch with them. I do, every 3rd of March, contact that group, and we raise a glass and we celebrate the fact that we're still here to talk about it and to reflect on that sad day and the positives that did come out of it. And there were some, but it was a sad day for cricket. It was a sad day for Pakistan. It was a sad day for the people involved. You know, in that book, a chapter, it's a very much a human interest story around how we see life differently, how we see events differently, and that doesn't make them right or wrong. It just means that 75% of the world are not like you and me. And to this day, loud noises affect me. I don't like fireworks. I don't like people dropping their knife and fork at the dinner table. You know, those sorts of things. And we process it differently, and Steve Davis has processed it completely differently to me, and that's okay. But we have much stronger relationships as a result. And having gone back to Pakistan earlier on this year for the first time in about 11 years was a very interesting experience around trust, around trying to put the game first. And some of you may know that I still serve on an MCC Laws subcommittee, and Kumar Sangakkara is part of MCC currently, also went back there to lead an MCC team. And I think that's part of our own rehabilitation. It's part of cricket's rehabilitation. It's part of bringing cricket back to Pakistan. But, you know, it's a different event, of course. It's a life-changing event. Every day we tend to try to see things better. We try to put things into perspective and realise how lucky we are and put things into context. And now that we're in COVID-19 and there's a lot more challenges around here and a lot of people are doing it tough, I'm here to tell you that there's always someone worse off than you are. And, you know, we can take great strength and courage from that. And how we look at life and how we look at what happens to us is entirely up to us. We have the power of choice. And just appreciate that people do see things differently. And we just have to respect that there's no right or wrong. There's just different. So that's probably what I'd have to say about that.
To move on to a more light-hearted subject in Pakistan, I took a team to Pakistan, had the great honour of doing this. We had, as you know, a wonderful welcome. Mm. And we played up in Miranshah. I was asked, I told it would be a village team, but when I looked at the village where we were, we were on a first-class ground, 15,000 Waziri tribesmen. And there we were, and we had watching, and we had a certain Inzamam al-Haq coming in to bat against us. Mm. Now, the following event occurred, and I want to... We had a very good umpire, Ian Vaughan Arbuckle. He's ECB qualified, very experienced. And we had a very nice left-arm spinner, Alex Massey, very reasonable bowler in the junior Scottish leagues. And he bowled the ball at Inzamam and up... LBW appeal and up, Ian Vaughan Arbuckle's finger went. There was a sort of hush in the ground, and Inzamam looked at the umpire, and didn't go anywhere at all. And there was a minor standoff, and Ian Vaughan Arbuckle's finger went down. Now, how would you have handled that situation?
That sounds like a W.G. Grace story to me.
Very close.
Yes.
How would umpire Taufel have dealt with that?
Well, look, essential to the way that I conduct myself and I think the brand of umpiring, it's about integrity and it's about doing the right thing. but, you know, social matches, and perhaps this was more of a social match, perhaps, than a competitive match.
It was live on national TV, by the way, in Pakistan. It was not, wasn't that social.
Well, it might lend another reason as to why the ICC Elite Panel came about, was around, you know, adding some independency, some neutrality to how umpires and people are appointed. But look, I wasn't there at the time. Maybe he quite correctly decided to change his mind. Who knows? But, look, for me, I just give them the way I see them. So if I think Inzi's out, I give him out. And if he's not out, I give him not out. But we do our best. So I wasn't there. I don't know. But it sounds like a very interesting story.
Yeah. I think, Simon, you wanted to say something more about the concept of the third force in cricket, the third team of umpires, scorers, you know, match officials, and their contribution to the game, which is something really quite new. It's emerged really in the last, 20 years or so.
Well, it has. It's a very... thank you for the opportunity of doing so, because particularly in this environment of COVID-19, I've seen here, particularly in Australia, with Cricket Australia and the various states actually cutting staff. Cricket Australia recently cut 40 staff. The states have cut approximately 150 staff around the country. Match officiating is not a profit centre, it's a cost centre. But we are an important part of the game. We don't seek to be the centre of attention. We don't seek to draw attention away from the players. And my mantra has always been to the umpires that I work with, is that how do we keep the focus on the cricket? In other words, let's do what the game expects and keep the focus on the cricket. And in this current environment where sport is trying to cut costs, I've seen firsthand where the governing bodies are looking at areas to do just that, and match officiating is a soft target. And we've worked really hard, as you say, over the last 20, 30 years to build up our systems, our structure around coaching, training, assessment, performance development. And in this country, in Australia, I've seen match officiating go back 20 years in the space of 10 weeks through a lot of staffing cuts, because when you cut people, you're cutting programs. And Cricket New South Wales, to their credit, have not cut people. They've reduced programs because they know that if you keep the people, the programs can come back. But if you cut the people, it makes it very, very difficult for the programs to come back. And unfortunately, there is always a performance time lag between what you do or don't do in sport and in business, between the current time right now and what might happen in 2 or 3 years. And while it might seem okay to cut now, you will see the outcomes of those cuts or that investment, if you look at it the other way, 2 or 3 years down the track. And at present, our system is under pressure. Every part of our sport is under pressure. And yes, it does cost to do what we do. But all of those investments, and this is where I get people to think about not the cost, but the value. The value investing in umpiring, scoring, match refereeing pays dividends. Because if we deliver world-class officiating and deliver what the game expects, then we do just that I talked about, of keeping the focus on the players, keeping the focus on the cricket, and delivering a really, really good game for people to watch and enjoy. And it's really important in this era to really try and ride these challenging times out by digging deep and trying to hold on to the experience and the talent that we do have, and not go backwards in this area, because I've said for many, many times that you've got more first-class teams that are better resourced, cricket team, than you've got national officiating panels. So if you take any full member country in the world in cricket and you look at their national officiating structure and how they're resourced with either an umpire coach or an umpire trainer or someone looking after assessment or someone managing match referees, you will find that a first-class cricket team has actually got more resources to improve their performance as a team than the national officiating part of the organisation has got. And if that's the case, surely there's something wrong. Surely there's an opportunity to provide those people who go out there to perform a very public and important role to deliver against high expectations of the people who watch and play, and give them the best chance of being successful and support that process. You know, I just think it's incumbent upon all of us to make sure that when we think about what we're doing for the players, we give equal consideration to the match officials, the match referees, and the umpires and scorers.
Can I ask you a question about that? Are umpires, you sort of fell into it, you described by mistake, but then became the greatest umpire in the world. Now, what is there a proper career structure now? And can you make a living as an umpire, you know, on the international stage, which is worth it?
It depends where you live. But the short answer is yes, that there is a pathway, but every country has a slightly different pathway. Some are more clearer than others, but there is a pathway. But it's fascinating at the moment, and talking to some ICC elite panel umpires only last week, that they've taken a massive pay cut. And what's really important is that we remunerate fairly, we remunerate responsibly, because there is a lot of expectation, demand, time commitment, sacrifice, and expectation placed on international cricket umpires in this day and age.
What is the size of that pay cut? That's most interesting, very important.
I'm not sure it's my place to share that, but it is significant because we worked really hard in 2009 when I was on the panel with our executive of umpires to negotiate an MOU with the ICC that rewarded elite panel umpires based on performance, which looked at decent match fees, which looked at decent retainers, and provided some certainty of income. Because if I went back to Darryl Hare's era, particularly around when he was suspended from the elite panel after the Oval Test match, he was only on a match fee. All the umpires at that stage were only on match fees. So if he didn't get a match as appointed by ICC, he didn't get paid anything. So we worked really hard to improve that system as a result of some deficiencies that we thought existed, to look at smoothing out the income based on retainers, normal matches that you officiate, plus a performance component, which then gave you a monthly retainer. And, you know, it's really important that we remunerate to provide incentive to improve performance, but also to recognise how much time you do spend away from home and the sacrifices that you do make that are equivalent with our current panel. When I joined the elite panel, our average age was 53. So back in 2003, the average age of an elite panel was 53. When I left in 2012, the average age dropped to 49. We're seeing younger and younger elite panel umpires now appointed. Nitin Menon recently from India, who's 35 years of age. So we're seeing a further trend towards umpires who are probably in the middle of their professional career outside of cricket, that have a young family and are being not forced, but the trade is that you will spend most of your year working away from home. We don't really have a home season as such. And it's important to be remunerated because you don't know how long that career is going to last. And it's really important that you are compensated for that.
I mean, listening to what you're saying there, Simon, it raises a very worrying question, which is corruption. We know that the players who get paid much more than the umpires, and there's been a real
some
issue
do.
With match.
Some do.
Yeah, can do anyway. Have you ever got a sense that some umpires are susceptible to match fixing, bribery, etc. as well?
Look, there is always that possibility. And I think regardless of whether it's a player or an official or anyone else involved in international cricket, we need to be alert but not alarmed. But what I would say is that there are a number of strings to this bow to how we manage and deal with corruption. The first primary one is education. The first one that we really have to focus on is how do we get that education, that message, that power of choice down to our pathway cricketers when they're still at school about why it's important to act responsibly, intelligently, with integrity, and understand what the message is that if they are concerned or if they are approached or if they feel as though that there's an element of greed here or there's an approach, that there's a process that will protect them and keep them and the sport safe. And we need to get that message down to our younger cricketers because this generation's gone. It's really hard to re-educate the older cricketers. We need to get this message, and then we need to have regular touch points with all of those people involved to ensure that they do that and they keep reconnecting with what's important and why it's important and protect the heritage of our game and protect the future of it as well. And then you would look at the pay cycle or the remuneration that you've touched on to make it less attractive to fall into temptation. And England play their cricketers really well. Australia pay their cricketers very well. But there are lots of other countries that don't. And it's just a factor that has to go into the mix. But at the end of the day, everyone's got choice. And we need to make sure that we deal with what we can control, which is the education side of things. And that's where the focus, in my mind, has to be.
Simon, you're very positive in your book and also in your Spirit of Cricket lecture, which you gave in 2013 at Lord's, which we haven't mentioned so far. You're very positive about change in cricket. You say that you said in 2013 that the game was much better than the game you came into.
I think there are a number of positives in our game at the moment. I think if I look at women's cricket and I look at the way that it has grown, developed, improved around skill, competitiveness, attractiveness and fan viewership, I think the way that the female cricketers have conducted themselves both on and off the field has been somewhat refreshing. They're very accessible, they're very humble, they're very passionate, and in general, they behave extremely well, and they produce a brand of cricket that is very appealing and attractive. And when you look at the recent successful Cricket World Cup for females, culminating in the final in Melbourne between India and Australia, that was just a great advertisement, I think, for our international game. And I think that's a really great advancement in our game. There are a lot of other positive things around the skill that has really developed in the game. When you look at the shorter formats and what players, batsmen can do these days, what bowlers can do, it's quite encouraging to see a brand of cricket that is generally quite exciting. And I'm here to say that I think our three formats of the game can exist quite well, providing they're competitive. I don't think it matters whether it's a test match, a T20 or a one-dayer. If you have two competitive teams that play an interesting, exciting brand of cricket, the formats are relevant. And I would like to see that continue, no question. The challenges for the game still remain around the growth and accessibility and development. I'd certainly like to see a World Cup that is a little bit more expansive and actually see more countries be able to qualify for a World Cup, to have more of a pathway and opportunity to compete on the world stage. And if you look at one of the key pillars of the International Cricket Council, it's to grow the game. And we just need to be very mindful of that for cricket to be successful, we need to continue to have a very broad base of competitive teams. We can't just have two or three iconic series or two or three competitive teams. We need to have a breadth and a broadness to that. So I'd like to see the game continue to develop. And that obviously takes money and it takes opportunity as well. And how the ICC continues to balance growing revenue as opposed to growing the game and how they mix and blend is really important. And of course, around governance, it's really important that we always put growing cricket first and foremost in our decision making. And how do we do the right thing for cricket rather than my country?
One last question.
Sure.
As one of the great umpires of the modern era, is there one law, can you name one law you would like to see changed?
Yeah, I've been on record saying this, Peter, that I would like to see the leg by law changed. I personally believe the game is between bat and ball, and I don't see why the batting team should be able to score runs if they can't hit the ball.
So a leg by is a dead ball, in other words, you'd say?
Yes. It's a game between bat and ball, and if you can't hit the ball, why should you be able to score runs?
That's a very stern law. That would, Simon, that would cut out most of my scoring over my career. I think I've scored more leg byes than I've scored runs. Simon, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. There's so much more we could have discussed. Maybe you'll come back if you've enjoyed the experience. We'd certainly love to have you back. In the meantime, thank you so much for being with us. Best wishes to everyone in Bowral, and thank you again.
Thank you. That's fine, Richard, and to you, Peter. I really enjoyed this session. I really would encourage people to look at becoming a cricket umpire or a cricket scorer and contribute to the game in any way that they can. So hopefully we've put a positive spin on being a cricket umpire, and hopefully people will pick up the book, Finding the Gaps, and look for ways that they can improve who they are and what they do.
Thank you so much, Simon. And next week, we've got another terrific guest looking ahead at the forthcoming Pakistan tour. We have the chairman of the Pakistan Cricket Board, Ahsan Mani, talking about his work for them, looking ahead at the Pakistan Cricket Tour. And we'll also ask him about his role in transforming the finances of world cricket. Thank you very much indeed. It's Peter O'Born saying goodbye from West London.
You're still in Chiswick, aren't you?
yes.
you weren't doing this on the run, were you? and I'm saying goodbye. It's Richard Heller, and I've always been in Bermondsey, and I still am. Goodbye.
goodbye.